for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Prospects are dimming for a coordinated international effort against ISIS. Yesterday, Turkey shot down a Russian fighter jet it claimed had violated its airspace. Joining me to talk about the Russian jet, French President Hollande's appeal to the U.S., and threats posed by ISIS, Rosa Brooks of Georgetown University Law Center, retired Lieutenant General James Dubik of the Institute for the Study of War, Steve Pfeiffer of the Brookings Institution, and joining us by phone from the London School of Economics, Fawaz Jurjez. I invite you to be part of the program. Give us your thoughts by calling 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And thank you all for joining us.
Welcome. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Good to have you all. Steve Pfeiffer, I'll start with you. Turkey says that the Russian plane flew over its territory. Russia says it did not, that it was flying into Syria. What do we know?
Well, there were these competing claims. The Turks put out their radar track, which showed the Russian aircraft approaching Turkish territory and then entering Turkish territory for a small time. But the backdrop to this is that since the Russian air campaign in Syria began at the end of September, there have been a number of Russian incursions into Turkish airspace with very strong Turkish warnings. And then in October, the Turkish Air Force shot down a Russian drone over Turkey. So it may have reached a point where the Turks said the Russians aren't taking us seriously, that they got fed up, and they did this to deliver a message.
So what's the backlash going to be?
Well, that remains to be seen. Yesterday, Vladimir Putin took a very hard line, said there would be tragic consequences, was the term he used, for Russian-Turkish relations. There was also a lengthy press conference today with Foreign Minister Lavrov in Moscow. But it seems at this point the Russian response has really been limited to three actions. First of all, Mr. Lavrov was supposed to be in Ankara today. He canceled that visit yesterday. Second, the Russians are telling Russian citizens not to travel to Turkey. Of course, southern Turkey has been a desirable vacation spot for many Russians. And then third, the Russian military has said that they're going to move stronger air defense assets, the S-300 and the S-400 surface-to-air missiles, into their air base near Latakia in Syria. That will be of concern to the Turks because those missiles can actually reach into Turkish airspace. But so far, that seems to be the limit of the Russian action. The Russians are not taking a military response to Turkey.
And what do we know about the pilots?
We've heard that one of the pilots was killed apparently after both pilots were successfully ejected from the aircraft after it was shot down. It appears that one of the pilots was actually shot while he was in his parachute. And was dead before he hit the ground.
By Syrian forces.
By rebel forces in northern Syria. And then the other pilot appeared to evade capture, and the Russians have announced today that they successfully recovered him and that he's been returned to Russian control.
And turning to you, General Dubik, this is the first time in half a century, more than half a century, that a NATO member has shot down a Russian plane. So how significant does this become?
Well, this could be very significant because we have now two NATO members, France and Turkey, who have been under attack, who have reason to think about claiming Article 5 of the NATO alliance. And so the negotiations among the NATO members should be extensive and should be very explicit so that we don't back our way into something that none of the members want.
And Rosa Brooks, explain how Turkey's interests are different from those of Syria, those of Russia in terms of Syria.
Right. I think one of the biggest problems here is that very few of the actors involved have the same interests. Turkey has obviously had a longstanding internal terrorist threat, an internal separatist threat from the Kurds who live inside of Turkey. Those very same Kurds are currently seen by the U.S. as our best hope in fighting against ISIS. So Turkey doesn't like the very same people we are supporting. Turkey has not yet closed its border with Syria. The U.S. is very concerned that the flow of foreign fighters into Syria is coming through Turkey, but Turkey has so far been reluctant to do anything about that. Meanwhile, the French just want to go after ISIS, and the Russians want to go after everybody except ISIS.
And to you, Fawaz Sherjes, French President Hollande's mission here to the U.S. comes on the heels of the awful attacks in France, apparently carried out by ISIS-affiliated operatives. What is the latest on the investigations going on in both France and Belgium?
Well, I mean, obviously, ISIS or Daesh has taken responsibility not just for the massive operation in Paris, but also the downing of the Russian jet over Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt and the massacre in Beirut a few days before the Paris attacks in which hundreds were killed and injured. What we have seen in the last few months, Diane, is that ISIS now is devoting more and more resources to foreign targets, the so-called the far enemy, as opposed to keeping its focus on Iraq and Syria. And what it has done, it has basically succeeded in co-opting some radicalized young men and women, in particular in Belgium and France. I mean, the fact is, ISIS would not have been able to do what it has done in Paris without having a foothold. That is, you have radicalized individuals, Belgians and French, plus ISIS has about 4,000 Westerners who are basically fighting within its ranks. And one of the ISIS suspects, his name is Abdelhamid Abaoud, basically returned from Syria and was able to organize the limited networks in Belgium and France that was able to basically carry out 7 or 8 suicide bombings on the heart affair so far.
So right after the attacks, you have President Hollande declaring that France is at war. Is that precisely what ISIS wants?
Absolutely. I understand. I was in Paris during that evening, and I go every Friday to Paris, and the city was traumatized. It really was a battle zone for 3 hours from 9:20 p.m. till 12:30 in the morning, in the at midnight. You have 7 or 8 basically killers terrorizing the city. The city is traumatized. The nation is traumatized. This is one of the biggest, basically, bloodbath in Paris in many years. So I understand the pain. But I think I'm afraid that the French might basically commit the same blunders that we did after 9/11 by saying this is war. You're talking about limited criminal networks. Masquerading as basically an ideological and religious, ideology. This is not war. Yes, they represent a threat. Yes, they are dangerous. But that's exactly what ISIS is trying to do, is to instill fear, to terrorize population, to force the Western powers, in particular the United States and France and England, to basically send boots on the ground, because they would change the narrative. Remember, Diane, the strategic goal of ISIS is not to wage war against the far enemy, but rather to consolidate the so-called Islamic State, that is the near enemy in Syria and Iraq. And by getting Western troops, if the United States or France or decide to send troops, they would change the narrative. After all, they would stand up and say, look, we are defending the Muslim community, the Ummah. The West is back at it again. And that's exactly what France and the United States and Britain should not do. They should not play into the hands of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, as we had played into the hands of Osama bin Laden after 9/11.
General Dubik, is that how you see it?
No, I have a little bit different perspective. I certainly agree with Fawad that the major objective is to consolidate and remain in Syria and Iraq, and that the FAR objectives are as he describes. But I think it's disingenuous of us not to call this a war. I mean, after all, both ISIS and Al-Qaeda are not merely criminal networks. They are also organizations, global organizations, who have as their objective to depose standing governments they call apostates and reestablish a political order. This is classic use of violence for political means by more than just criminal organizations.
However, can we consolidate U.S., French, British, and Russian forces without Russia?
That's going to be the big question when French President Hollande goes to Moscow tomorrow to meet with Vladimir Putin. And one of the problems, and perhaps the biggest obstacle to a broader international effort against ISIS and against the Islamic State, is so far, when you look at what the Western coalition is doing and what the Russians have been doing in military terms, they have very different targets. The Russian military objective appears to be to bolster the Assad regime. So while they've conducted a few airstrikes against the Islamic State, most of those airstrikes are going against groups that are a much more urgent threat against Assad, including hitting groups that the West regards as more moderate opposition groups who have to be part of the coalition. The question is, can we get the Russians to agree to hit Islamic State?
Steve Piper of the Brookings Institution. He was U.S. ambassador to Ukraine from 1998 to 2000. Short break. We'll be right back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. We're talking about French President Hollande's visit to the U.S. We are talking about the shootdown of a Russian plane flying over Turkey's border. At least that's what Turkey claims. Russia said it did not touch Turkey's border. What do we make of these differences, Rosa Brooks, in the attitude, and how do we know whether Russia actually flew over Turkey's border or not?
You know, that's a good question, and it is possible, I don't know, but it's possible that our own intelligence and surveillance equipment and agencies have some ability to answer that question definitively, but I don't know for a fact that we can answer it, and I don't know for a fact that if we can answer it, that we will make that answer public. We may decide that it's better to keep it a little bit vague and let everybody back off from this confrontation.
What do you think, General Dubik?
Well, I have seen, like most people, the non-classified tracks, and the track that the Turks released shows the very little bit of land, Turkish airspace that the Russians violated. But as Rosa said, look, these things are not as empirical as they appear. And it could be that the real investigation will find that they didn't violate airspace.
Ambassador.
Yeah, the one thing that the Pentagon, though, did confirm is they said that they did hear the Turkish air defense authorities give repeated warnings to the Russian pilot that you were approaching Turkish airspace and should turn south.
Approaching.
Approaching. And the way I read the track, it looks like the warnings were given as the plane approached Turkish airspace. The Turks then say they shot it down after it entered Turkish airspace.
And obviously one of the difficulties here is these planes travel so fast that the time lapse between you're approaching and you're in it and you're out again is seconds.
What does this rift between Turkey and Russia mean for a coalition to go after ISIS?
Before I try to answer your question, Diane, the question is not whether the Russian plane or fighter jet basically crossed into Turkish territories. We have to wait and see. The question is, why did Turkey decide to shoot down the Russian plane now and not before? And one of the context is very important for your own listeners. In the last 2 or 3 weeks, the Russians have been bombing some areas in northern Syria where a community, an ethnic community called the Turkoman, would basically have close links with Turkey. This is a community that has many links and ties to Turkey. And the Turkish government has been very angry. In fact, it called the Russian ambassador just a few days before the downing of the Russian plane, and it protested in very strong language. And the Syrian army has made major inroads into this particular community, which is almost 3 kilometers away from Turkey. So you have a context here whereby, I would say that the Turkish government and this analysis sent a very strong message. It wanted to send a message to Russia that Turkey has strategic interests in Syria, and there are red lines in which basically the Syrian army and the Russian forces did not really respect. As to your question, and this goes to the very heart of what's happening in Syria. We keep talking about Syria. Somehow ISIS has been able to build, to take over almost 50% of Syria because of its strategic might, military might. One of the reasons why ISIS and al-Nusra Front, we're talking about ISIS, al-Nusra Front, the official arm of al-Qaeda, is as powerful as ISIS. The reason why they have done as well as they have, you have regional war by proxies. You have a global rivalry. You have a war between Saudi Arabia, Sunni-dominated Saudi Arabia, and Shia-dominated Iran. Turkey, the strategic goal of Turkey for the last 4 years is to bring the temple down on everyone had in Syria in order to topple Assad and prevent the Kurds from establishing an autonomous region on the Turkish-Syrian borders. The Americans and the Russians basically have different clashing interests, and that's why ISIS has been able to manipulate and exploit the cleavages, the divisions among the regional powers and get arms and money and resources and the global powers. And what this means is that the so-called the broadly based coalition, basically to take on ISIS now, it has received a major blow. How are you now, Turkey and Russia? I mean, you asked earlier, the first question you asked about what will Russia's response be? Make no doubt about it. The response will be inside Syria. You're going to see qualitative more escalation that we have seen in northern Syria because Putin, basically, this was a major slap in the face. And he would inside Syria, not just in terms of economic and visitors, Russian visitors to Turkey.
Do you agree, Steve Piper?
Well, you saw reports today that there were Russian airstrikes again in northern Syria, again aimed at the Turkmen population, which the Turks support. So you can see that kind of pressure building up there. And the question will be, how do the Turks respond? My guess is with Erdogan, the Turks are not going to back off. So you have, again, these two very strong egos in the form of Putin and Erdogan that may come to some kind of a clash.
General Dubik, you said that without strategic goals, there is no military answer here.
Well, actually, without some kind of some durable political solution that we're trying to achieve, it's hard to say what any military action is necessary, good, bad, or indifferent, because military action is an instrument to achieve a political outcome. The political outcome is ambiguous. I think to Fawad's point about the coalition, if the standard for a coalition is going to be a grand alliance to which everyone agrees, we better lower our expectations and start figuring out maybe combinations of coalitions to attain different portions of the strategic games. Well, you could ally with Saudi Arabia and Jordan for one portion of the strategic game, ally with Turkey with another, maybe exclude Russia for a time and include them in a talking arena. This is why we have really good diplomats to figure out innovative ways short of a grand alliance, which no one should expect in this kind of case.
Rosa.
I think you're letting us off the hook a little bit too much here. I'm going to be even more blunt. I think number one problem we face, obviously, is the fact that all the other players in this conflict have conflicting interests. But problem number two, which is an enormous one, I'm not sure the United States has the faintest idea what our strategic interest is. And, you know, one possibility, and we say all of these things at different times, but in some ways they're mutually contradictory. We want to defeat ISIS. We want to stabilize stabilize Syria. We want justice in Syria, either, e.g., the bad guy, Assad, is gone. We want to prevent or reduce the threat of global terrorism. And frankly, some of those goals are probably in tension with others. So we don't even know what we want, which makes this all the more difficult.
I'm with Rosa 100% on that, not just in Syria, but in Iraq. And I think in the larger global war, the counter to Fawad's point, against al-Qaeda and ISIS.
But Steve Pieper, hasn't the U.S., in terms of what President Obama said yesterday, backed away just a tad from having al-Assad step down?
Yeah, I think you've seen an evolution in the American position. A bit of softening where it used to be Assad has to go immediately,
right,
to this idea. There's this now this process which began in Vienna where you brought a lot of parties together. And the question is, can they agree on some sort of a set of principles for what a political transition process in Syria would look like? Now, the American position seems to be, okay, Assad might be there at the start of that process, although clearly I think the Americans believe, as do the French and others, that Assad cannot be there at the end. But then this will be, I think, a second issue for President Hollande in Moscow, is not only can the West and Russia agree on Islamic State as the target for the military campaign, but can they also agree on some basic principles for what this political process that would hopefully result in some kind of a peaceful settlement in Syria, what that looks like?
Fawaz, Shershis, is that all wishful thinking on the part of the U.S.?
Well, I think it's wishful thinking on the part of most powers, because, what you have in Iraq and Syria, you have raging civil wars. ISIS is not just a terrorist organization. ISIS is partly counterinsurgency. ISIS has been able to blend with local poor Sunni communities in both Iraq and Syria and Libya, and basically depict itself as their sole defender. If you ask me, how are you going to deal with ISIS? The military component is just one angle. The most effective means, if our reading of ISIS is correct, the difference between al-Qaeda Central, al-Qaeda Abu Osama bin Laden, and Ayman Zawahiri, and ISIS, is that ISIS basically has been able to blend in with local communities. It's part of the civil wars that are raging in the heart of the Arab world without resolving these civil wars. And how do you resolve these civil wars? They're all about identities, they're about ethnic and sectarian basically sentiments, without bridging the divide between Saudi and between Iran. How are you going to basically starve ISIS and the other militants without basically meeting the strategic goals of Turkey? I mean, Turkey, yes, finally, Turkey has joined the fight against ISIS, but the reality is Turkey's strategic goal is to prevent the Kurds from establishing an autonomous region on the Turkish-Syrian borders, even though they are interested now in taking on ISIS. So you have clashing interests, you have raging fires and civil wars, and again, these militant extremist groups are nourished in conflict zones. And without dealing with the root causes, that is the civil wars, that is the regional war by proxies, I don't think this particular thing called ISIS is going to be dealt with either in a year or two, unfortunately.
Moving on, Steve Pieper, a number of people have suggested a no-fly zone, that the U.S. move to establish a no-fly zone. Number one, how realistic is it? Number two, how would it be enforced?
Well, I think that was a possibility until the end of the September. And then when the Russian Air Force began flying missions in Syria, the no-fly zone, to my mind, became very, very hard to do. Because if you're going to have a no-fly zone, ultimately you have to be prepared to have the American Air Force shoot down planes that enter that zone. It was one question if you were talking about shooting Syrian planes down. It's another question if you're talking about shooting down the Russian Air Force. So my guess at this point, it's very hard to see how you could impose a no-fly zone over Syria per se, maybe over some very narrow bands, but even that gets dicey when you have competing air forces operating in the same contested airspace.
General Dubik?
Well, I tend to agree with Steve on the difficulty of a no-fly zone, but I don't think we ought to throw it out just because of the difficulty. I think it is the case that to start getting at some of the political issues and social issues that Fawaz has talked about, you need a protected space to do that. And maybe that protective space is small to begin with. Again, it doesn't have to be a grand alliance at one level. It doesn't have to be a grand no-fly
zone. But what would it take militarily?
It would take a commitment to protect the airspace just as Steve has, and probably an agreement with Russia not to fly in that zone. That's a tough agreement in certain parts of northern Syria. It's not tough in other parts of Syria.
How
maybe
do you
the south
see
areas.
It, Rosa?
Well, I think this gets us back to Fuad's earlier point, which is how do we avoid playing into ISIS's hands? And indeed, Jim's earlier point that you can do all sorts of things militarily, but to what end? You have to know how you're evaluating it. And my concern would be, is it militarily feasible for the United States to create and enforce a no-fly zone in a protected space? Yeah, at a certain amount of cost and complexity, it is feasible. But what does that do in terms of playing into the ISIS narrative, playing into the propaganda machine of, oh, here, once again, the United States is meddling outside of their affairs? You're going to end up having to have people on the ground at some stage or another. You're going to end up having to destroy more targets on the ground, et cetera.
Rosa Brooks of Georgetown University Law Center. She's also a columnist for Foreign Policy. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm going to open the phones. We'll take some calls. 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Charlie, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Diane. Happy Thanksgiving weekend.
Thank you.
I'm calling because I've seen, you know, we all have seen the French become more involved in attacking ISIS, just fighting ISIS in Syria, which I applaud, that there's more than just the United States. My question is, how much involvement did they have prior to those bombings in Paris? And can you compare the French involvement before the bombings in Paris to the U.S. involvement? Because I see a lot of talking points that the French are decisively attacking ISIS and they're so strong and the U.S. is weak. And I'd like to understand more about how those two forces compare in efforts.
But why is yours?
Thank you for the question. And yes, happy Thanksgiving. The United States so far has carried out around 8,000 airstrikes, give and take, in Iraq and Syria. Up till the suicide attacks in Paris, France has carried out about five or probably four attacks in Syria. So there is no comparison whatsoever. France has been basically involved mainly in Iraq, but again, there is no comparison between what the United States has been doing or its allies. In fact, probably more than 93% of all airstrikes in Iraq and Syria are by the United States. Because given its massive, air fleet and its capacity. And this brings really a critical question. The question is, we know now that ISIS cannot be defeated from air through airstrikes. You need to dislodge ISIS from major cities and towns. You do it in two ways. You either deploy Western boots on the ground, or you basically provide capacity to local forces. The Iraqi army, the Kurds in Iraq, the Kurds in Syria, and, of course, various opposition rebels. This takes a long time, and this is really where Barack Obama is. I hate to say it here, but Barack Obama is correct. In fact, in order to really defeat ISIS, in order to hammer a deadly nail in the coffin of ISIS, you have to basically help local communities to stand up and dislodge ISIS from major towns and cities. This is the only effective strategic way to defeat ISIS once and for all. The question is, this is a long strategy. And in the meantime, ISIS basically consolidates its Islamic State and basically expands and have affiliates in many countries to wage war against, Middle Eastern states and also against Western powers as well.
So, Steve Pfeiffer, he is talking about arming those who are there rather than putting boots on the ground.
And that's part of the way to go. There's no enthusiasm in America or Europe to put large numbers of Western ground forces into Syria or into Western Iraq. So if you're going to assemble a ground force that complements the Western air campaign, you're looking, as he said, you're looking at the Iraqi army, you're looking at the Kurds, you're looking at opposition groups on the ground.
And we'll take a short break here. More of your calls, comments, when we come back. Welcome back, General Dubik. I know you wanted to follow up on the idea of training local forces to resist, to fight. But you're saying in order to do that, you need U.S. trainers.
Well, you need trainers, U.S. or other coalition members. They have to. This is a very human, face-to-face, confidence-building activity. If I'm going to be sent in to train someone, it's not like a bass fish where I catch it and release it. I train it and release it. I stay with them. I build their confidence. I increase their capacity of fighting while they're fighting.
So you're differentiating between a few advisors and massive troops on the ground.
Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly.
How effective, Hawaz Yerges, do you believe that would be?
Well, by the way, we don't have just a few trainers. We have almost 4,000 trainers in Iraq. In fact, one of the major problems faced by the military, and speak to the American military, is that they don't have enough recruits in Iraq. So this is not about the question of sending 4,000 trainers. You can train 50, 60, 70,000 local forces in 6 or 7 months. And American officials have been complaining about the fact that they don't have enough recruits, point one. In Syria, it's a very complex situation. It's a very complex situation because you have Syria has gone to a million pieces. The question of vetting the rebels. You have thousands of warlords in Syria. You have regional war by proxies. At the end of the day, if you send American boots on the ground, you're going to make a huge quantitative difference in terms of defeating ISIS. The question is, how about the implications, the repercussions? How would ISIS and al-Nusra Front exploit this particular decision by the United States and the Western powers to send troops? My take on it is that the next American president most likely will inherit this particular portfolio and might decide on increasing the number of American boots on the ground in both Iraq and Syria.
And what would you, if you had the power, Fawaz Yerges, what would you be doing right now?
Well, you know, Diane, I am an academic, and it's very easy for us to bark and be critical. This is, you know, we master the art of criticism. But it's really, really a very complex situation, and it is much more complex than you and I think. You're talking about deep cleavages. You're talking about the breakdown of institutions. You're talking about the social fabric that, you know, the ties that bind are very thin, the lack of trust. You're talking about, I mean, remember the reason why non-state actors, including ISIS and others, have been able to really create such, a huge mass, because the system is fragile. And when the system, the political and the social system is fragile, basically, all kinds of social epidemics infiltrate the system. What we need now is to really invest diplomatic, political, and social capital in rebuilding the institutions, rebuilding the state system. And this is a very complex task. It's not just about a military mission. It's about how do you rebuild the fragile institutions. And as we all know, it's easy said than done. This will take years, really generational. I know it's a cliche. You're talking about a decade or so to rebuild the state system, the broken state system in that part of the world.
All right. I'll go back to the phones to Kathleen in Dayton, Ohio. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Hey, I worked for and voted for Obama both times, but I, you know, has there foreign policy strategy in Syria been disastrous from the very beginning? I mean, all we heard was Assad must go over and over again. And according to the Leverett's, Flint and Hillary Mann Leverett at Middle East Experts, 4.5 years ago they were writing about negotiate with Assad. Okay, he's a murderer and, you know, a bad guy. But that if with negotiations, is it too late to still negotiate? And wouldn't have negotiations kept the doors closed to ISIS getting into Syria?
Rosa Brooks.
It's possible. There's obviously no way to know at this point. I do think it's fair to say that the Obama administration's policy on Syria has been a mess, really, from day one. And one thing that is clear to me is that some early opportunities were lost. And, you know, whether we could have found some way to avoid getting Assad backed into a corner and prevented a lot of the bloodshed that's occurred, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. Whether we could have intervened early on the side of the group that at the time we did have some more secular, more moderate Syrian rebels, could that have made a decisive difference? Maybe it could have. Trouble is now, obviously, we are where we are. And my concern right now is that we really, if anything, almost need a sort of strategic pause here, because we do not know what is going on. And one of the painful lessons that we should have learned from Iraq and many other situations is we can train lots of local forces. They will fight as long as they think it is in their interest to do so, but they will not risk their lives to defend what they see as our interests if their interests differ from ours. Right now, we have lots and lots of actors on the ground with conflicting interests. We have very few people. We've, you know, 50 special forces, special operations troops on the ground in Syria. We don't know who the players are. We don't really know what they want. We don't know how loyal they're likely to be to our interests, and their interests are not the same as ours. I think that that's a situation where, as Fawaz says, you focus your energies on diplomacy and political solutions rather than on blundering in with more military action without a clear sense of what we can achieve or indeed what we want to achieve.
Steve Pfeiffer.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, I think the Obama administration probably led its understandable abhorrence for the Assad regime. Remember, this guy is responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of Syrians. He's responsible for the fact that millions of Syrians have had to flee the country. But that probably became a roadblock to engaging him in some way. And there was one question, I'm not sympathetic to a lot of the Russian views on Syria, but there was one question that we never really had a good answer for when the Russians would say, if Assad goes, what comes next? And we didn't have a strategy, we didn't have a way of answering that made anybody particularly comfortable.
Do we have a clearer answer to that question now?
I sure don't. I mean, when you look at the mess on the ground in Syria now, I think it's very hard to project what comes next.
This has been one of the problems with building, quote-unquote, a free Syrian army. An army is an entity that fights for a political organization, a political community. You can't create an army without a political community, yet we tried for years. And so, you know, in this regard, because of the complexities that we're all acknowledging, it really does, I think, suggest to start small, not large, and to focus on local communities and build from there rather than try to something grand and work down.
To John in Arlington, Virginia, you're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
I wanted to make two quick points and one major point. Point one is that the overall problem is a slow dissolution of the state system in the Middle East, and that can't be good. There's a lot of people to blame for that. Point two is the Russians have been in Syria forever, meaning since the mid-50s, the Iranians since 80, basically as a block against the Iraqis. So that, if people don't understand that's a long-term relationship that you just can't kind of sever and say, you know, it's okay, you got a problem there. Thirdly, as far as this Russo-Turkish thing, this isn't about legalities. This is about power. The Turks cross the borders on a regular basis to attack the PKK in northern Iraq because of that the group's support of the local rebels in Turkey. So, you know, I'm not sure what borders mean. But as far as the Russians go, it's quite clear that while there may have been minor incursions, the Turks again are involved in interference in Syria. And I suspect the Russians, in addition to putting those anti-aircraft missiles, are going to come down very hard on the Turks in northern Syria. And they're going to tell the Turks, okay, now what are you going to do?
Interesting. What do you think, Steve?
No, as I said, I think today you saw Russian airstrikes focused at that Turkmen population in northern Syria. And Turkey will react badly to that. So the question is, can Ankara and Moscow keep their differences here somewhat bounded?
Do you expect that they will? Rhetoric today, it sounds as though they might.
I think that both sides recognize, both in Moscow and Ankara, that they don't have an interest in seeing this spin wildly out of control. But also, you have two leaders who are also interested in portraying domestically that they are standing up for their country, they're standing up for their country's positions. And does that push them to do things that, you know, in a calmer sense, they might not otherwise choose to do?
And speaking of being on the defensive, what about ISIS, Fawaz? Some people have said ISIS is indeed on the defensive.
It is on the defensive. ISIS is losing territory in both Iraq and Syria. ISIS is besieged. You're talking about more than 15,000 of its fighters and mid-level leaders have been killed. The Americans have been gradually and systematically increasing the pressure on ISIS, in particular on its economy, its oil economy. But it's a slow process. ISIS is not imploding. Because of the regional war by proxies, because of its ability to manipulate and exploit the divisions in both Iraq and Syria. So at the end of the day, this is a very slow, prolonged, complex strategy. At the end of the day, I think Barack Obama is correct. ISIS will be defeated, make no doubts about it. The question is, what will be the cost and how long? And in the meantime, can the international community afford the cost, given the fact that ISIS now has been able to co-opt recruits and networks in many countries in the Middle East, and in fact in European countries, in particular in France and the United Kingdom, where I live, and Belgium and other places.
And you've also said, Fawaz, that ISIS has been able to undermine al-Qaeda. What do you mean by that, and what is the significance?
Well, you know, Diane, al-Qaeda no longer exists as a centralized organization. It's gone. Because I think the Americans have been able to dismantle the centralized organization by killing the top leadership, the mid-level leaders. In many ways, ISIS has basically taken leadership of the global jihadist movement. Quickly, I know we don't have the time, give you an idea. At the height of its power, al-Qaeda never numbered more than 2,000, 3,000 fighters. Al-Qaeda never controlled land or people. ISIS has an army between 30,000 and 100,000, give and take. ISIS controlled the lives between 5 million and 8 million people. ISIS controlled the state as big as where I live in the United Kingdom. And ISIS now, and it has the narrative of triumphalism, of winning, and that's why its message appeals to some deluded man in many parts of the world, and that's why the flow of fighters. So, yes, and that's why we are seeing now al-Qaeda, the various al-Qaeda divisions, are trying to compete with ISIS, stand up and say, look, we still exist. My take is that the Mali attacks a few days ago was a kind of message on the part of the al-Qaeda to say to ISIS, yes, you did the Russian jet, yes, you carried out the suicide bombings in Beirut and the massacre in Paris, but here we are. We still have capacity, we still exist, you cannot dismiss us as you have done in the last 3 years or so.
Fawaz Sjirtjes is chair of the Middle Eastern Center at the London School of Economics. He's the author of ISIS, A History, to be published in February of 2016. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Rosa, you've said that defeating ISIS will not make terrorism go away.
No, I think it's a pipe dream to think anything other than that. Terrorism is a method. There have been terrorists in the world for thousands of years. Obviously, ISIS has superseded al-Qaeda. Before we had al-Qaeda, we were worried about terrorist threats from Hamas and Hezbollah. Before that, it was the Abu Nidal group, Black September, etc. There have been Basque terrorists, IRA terrorists, Sri Lankan terrorists. terrorism is a tactic that's embraced by relatively weak actors who don't have strong conventional militaries, and sometimes by states, usually with some degree of covertness, because it's cheap and it's effective. And I think we in the panicky reaction to the Paris attacks, which were terrible, but not an existential threat to any country in the West, we see exactly why groups resort to terrorism. It works. It scares the heck out of people, and they overreact and they do self-destructive things.
So, General Dubik, in your mind, do we still have the possibility of creating a coalition against ISIS?
I think yes, as long as you understand, as I do, that it's not going to be a grand alliance. See, I think part of the discussion about the strategy here is to recognize that we are currently on a strategy of attrition, which makes three assumptions. Number one, that we, the coalition, the United States, have more resources than the enemy. Number two, we're willing to use those resources longer than the enemy's willing. And three, we have the will to use those resources longer than the enemy. And I think the first one, in terms of resources, no question. The other two, I think, are in question. And so a strategy of attrition may not be the best choice for us in the long term.
And to you, Ambassador Piper, what do you see as U.S. strategy in the long run?
Well, I think it's going to have to be very much a long-term effort. We're not going to be able to defeat ISIS or terrorism overnight. I think, as Rosa said, we're going to, even if we beat ISIS, if we eradicate it, there will be some other group out there that's going to embrace terror tactics. So it's a long-term campaign, and we have to just be prepared to continue to deal with it.
And finally, to you, Fawaz Georges, in just the few seconds we have, you say that alienation of the Muslim world could be the final nail in the coffin. What do we need to do to separate our interest from defeat of ISIS from our belief that most Muslims are not part of terrorism?
You know, Diane, first and foremost, this is a fight for the Arab and Muslim world. All the Western powers, including the United States, can do is to support, to assist, to help, to provide capacity. The good news, and I want to conclude on a piece of good news, is that ISIS, like Al-Qaeda, its own worst enemy. It has mastered the art of enemies. It has made enemies of the entire world, including the Muslim community. Its viciousness, savagery. ISIS is going to be defeated not because it's evil, and it is evil, because ISIS really does not have a strategic vision. It does not have a positive a blueprint for governance, and at the end of the day, it's gradually alienating not only mainstream Muslim public opinion, but even some of its fighters that they have been fighting with it in the last two or three years.
All right, and we'll have to leave it there. Thank you all for being with us, and happy Thanksgiving to all of you. I'm Diane Rehm.